Welcome to Corp Watch Radio, your weekly review of corporate news. Coming up, our headlines will take us from the Dubai Ports World acquisition to campaigns against Walmart and defense contractor scandals. Next, we have an interview with Free Speech Radio News' Aaron Glantz, who just got back from covering labor issues in Vietnam. But first, for the week of March 6th through March 13th, I'm Sakura Saunders.
And I'm Stephen Valentino.
And these are your Corp Watch headlines.
A Nigerian court ruled Friday that Royal Dutch Shell must pay $1.5 billion in damages for allowing its oil to spill into the rivers and swamps of the Niger Delta, spoiling crops and driving fish away. The payment of this fine to local communities was also one of a series of demands issued by militants last month during a campaign of sabotage and kidnapping against the oil industry. The militants made the demand after kidnapping four foreign oil workers in January, but released them after 19 days without Shell making any promises on the payment. The same militants are now holding more foreign oil workers captive and have threatened more attacks against oil installations if their demands are not met. The militants come from the Ija ethnic group, the majority group in the Delta, where an estimated 20 million people live, most in extreme poverty.
A company from the United Arab Emirates is being investigated by U.S. officials for potential future security risks. Dubai Ports World, a state-owned company in Dubai, recently bought London-based Peninsular and Oriental Steam Navigation Company for $6.8 billion. As part of the deal, the Dubai company would take over management of six major ports in the United States, including New York and Philadelphia. A number of Democratic and Republican members of Congress, along with the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, have joined forces to fiercely criticize the Bush administration for secretly approving the deal, which they say will open up the country to terrorism. The company has agreed to a special extra 45-day investigation to prove its case. Company supporters and activists say that the investigations are racist because European companies do not have to undergo similar checks when they buy American businesses. The majority of American ports are already run by foreign companies, especially from Britain and Denmark.
The world's largest gold producer, the U.S.-based Newmont Corporation, has agreed to pay the Indonesian government $30 million to settle a civil lawsuit, over $100 million less than the government requested. The lawsuit alleged that Newmont's mining operations had polluted the Boyat Bay and caused sickness in its nearby residents. The government pursued the lawsuit after villagers living near the mine became afflicted with tumors, skin rashes, and dizziness. The central environmental issue in the case involves the disposal of mine waste. The Indonesian Ministry of Environment claims that the waste from the gold mine contained high levels of arsenic and mercury, which entered the food chain through bottom-feeding organisms in the bay. The method that Newmont used to dispose of the waste is illegal in the United States. Newmont acknowledged the elevated levels of arsenic but denied that the fish were contaminated. The $30 million settlement will be used to set up an environmental monitoring and assessment program in the region. For the Boyat residents, a housing construction program will be implemented within 2 months.
You are listening to Corp Watch Radio. For more information about any of these stories, go to www.corpwatch.org.
In the Enron trial, former Vice President Paula Riker took the stand, testifying that the company had boosted its earnings per share numbers so that it would beat investor expectations. She also testified that Skilling had knowingly lied about how much revenue Enron's broadband was bringing in. Prosecutors are trying to prove that Lay and Skilling knew about the company's financial problems but lied to investors and employees. The overly rosy picture that they painted fraudulently caused millions of investors to lose their money while Lay and Skilling cashed out on their stock. Between 1999 and 2001, Lay took home $220 million, while Skilling earned $150 million. Skilling, 52, is charged with 31 counts of conspiracy, fraud, and insider trading. Lay, 63, is charged with 7 counts of conspiracy and fraud.
A coalition of labor unions and community activists, launched a campaign last week to force all large employers in the U.S. to pay a fixed percentage of their payroll towards health coverage. The campaign targets the inadequate health benefits offered by America's largest employer, Walmart. WakeUpWalmart.com, which is backed by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, claims that the world's largest retailer offers health insurance priced out of range for most of its 1.3 million U.S. workers, leaving them either uninsured or on taxpayer-funded programs. Walmart has responded to these accusations with their own series of press conferences, stating that they are taking steps to make their health care more affordable. They are also fighting the union-backed legislation and insist that the legislation will do nothing to solve the problem of the working uninsured. Meanwhile, a national retail association is fighting the bill in court. The proposed legislation requires large employers to spend at least 8% of their payroll for employee health coverage, or pay the difference to state programs for the uninsured. Labor unions are pushing bills in about 30 states, and legislation has already passed in Maryland.
A coalition of farmers, consumers, and environmental activists have filed a lawsuit claiming a type of Monsanto-patented genetically engineered alfalfa will spell havoc for farmers and the environment. The plaintiffs, which include the Sierra Club, the Center for Food Safety, and the National Family Farm Coalition, claim the U.S. Department of Agriculture had approved the alfalfa without studying its public health, environmental, and economic effects. Currently, alfalfa is the fourth most widely grown crop in the United States, behind corn, soybeans, and wheat. In addition to environmental dangers, the plaintiffs are also concerned about the possibility of a Monsanto alfalfa monopoly. They claim that the GM alfalfa, which cross-pollinates in the wind, will contaminate conventionally grown alfalfa at a fast pace, ultimately forcing farmers to pay for Monsanto's patented gene technology, whether they want the technology or not. The most infamous case of this scenario occurred in 1999, when Monsanto sued Percy Schmeiser, a small family farmer in Saskatchewan, Canada, whose fields were contaminated with the biotech giant's patented GM canola. Since then, it has sued U.S. farmers even when they have tried to keep their own fields free from contamination by nearby biotech plants. The suit also claims that farmers could lose an estimated $480 million per year in export business because major alfalfa buyers in Japan and South Korea have indicated they would refuse to buy GM-tainted crops. Monsanto has refused to comment.
The U.S. Senate held hearings last week on net neutrality, the principle that forbids Internet Service Providers, or ISPs, to discriminate in web content delivery. Simply stated, net neutrality is why the CorpWatch homepage will download to your computer just as fast as the White House's. Representatives of major Internet Service Providers, such as Comcast, Bell South, and SBC, argue that because they own the broadband cables, they ought to have the right to charge extra for quick and, quote, guaranteed delivery of data. Currently, ISPs are required to handle data in a similar fashion as telephone companies. All content must be processed equally, regardless of source. At the hearings, net neutrality backers warned that ISPs want to move away from the open internet to create an internet fast lane for their own services and their highest-paying clients, and a slow lane for everyone else. The issue of net neutrality involves much more than just the speed of delivery. Critics claim that if Congress sides with the corporations, a provider could potentially slow down delivery of content of which it does not approve. Because most Americans have little or no choice of broadband ISPs, this would essentially allow corporations to censor the internet. You're listening to CorpWatch Radio. For more information about any of these stories, go to www.corpwatch.org.
A major security subcontractor for the U.S. military in Iraq, Custer Battles, faced two separate legal cases this week. In a Virginia courtroom, the lawyer for two whistleblowers claimed the security firm founded by Scott Custer and Michael Battles defrauded the U.S. government of around $50 million in Iraq. Witnesses testified that the company, which won security and supply contracts, failed to provide adequate services and materials, and that the firm set up shell companies in the Cayman Islands to charge itself with thousands of dollars in fake invoices. In a separate lawsuit in Mobile, Alabama, a subcontractor for Custer Battles accused the firm of fraud and kidnapping. The subcontractor, a former FBI agent, claims that Custer Battles officials kidnapped him and his 14-year-old son at gunpoint. Custer Battles has denied the allegations and responded with a countersuit. But the two former veterans failed to attend a scheduled legal deposition because of their False Claims Act case in Virginia.
In another defense contracting scandal, former Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham was sentenced to 8 years and 4 months in prison, the longest term ever given to a congressman. Cunningham pled guilty to tax evasion and conspiracy to commit bribery and fraud. The former Republican congressman admitted to using his staff members to influence government officials while accepting millions in bribes in exchange for government contracts. Prosecuting attorneys wrote in their sentencing papers that Cunningham had put a for sale sign on the U.S. Capitol and that his crimes were unprecedented for a sitting member of Congress. You are listening to Corp Watch Radio. For more information about any of these stories, go to www.corpwatch.org. All right, we are now joined with Free Speech Radio News' Aaron Glantz, who recently got back from Vietnam, where he was covering labor issues there. Thanks for being on the show. So, your recent story was about the strikes that led up to the increase in minimum wage. Would you mind explaining your story?
Well, it's really an incredible story, and most people in America are not aware of the fact that there are very large strikes in Vietnam against these companies, which are subcontractors for Nike or Adidas or even toy companies, toys that you might see in McDonald's Happy Meals or toys that they might sell at Starbucks or pretty much anything that they make in Vietnam that's bound for our market. The labor situation is not as peaceful as some might think. And in January of this year, there were an unprecedented 40,000 workers who all marched out nearly simultaneously over a few days at different factories around Ho Chi Minh City and all demanding that the minimum wage, which had been had actually gone down over the last few years, be increased from $35 a month, so less than a dollar and a quarter a day, to something a little more reasonable.
And why had the minimum wage actually gone down?
Well, the minimum wage didn't actually go down in the way that it was set. The minimum wage was set as a certain amount in Vietnamese dong. But during the last 6 years, the dong has lost a lot of value, both against the U.S. dollar and in terms of its purchasing power in Vietnam. So people were getting paid the same. But in the terms of the foreign companies that were employing these people who were doing all of their trade in dollars, they were actually having to shell out less dollars every month to pay their workers at the same time that the dong, each one of those dong was buying less in the marketplace.
And how many strikes were there?
Well, initially, it was sparked by a strike of 18,000 workers at this company called Freetrend, which is a Hong Kong-based company that owns factories that make shoes for Nike and Adidas. And this 18,000-strong walkout was then followed by other strikes during the month of January, leading to about 40,000 people on strike at one time in January, which caused the government to increase the minimum wage by 40%. But since then, the strikes have continued because the minimum wage increase doesn't actually take effect until April. And people in Vietnam, they want their increase now because their wages have been stagnant for so long. And also some people are complaining that factory owners are giving them this raise, but they're taking it out in other ways. They're taking away some of their fringe benefits, their lunch breaks, their coffee breaks. They're making them work longer hours for the new increase, and so it's not really an increase at all. And so every week you have more than 1,000 workers walking off the job in Vietnam since the government's decision in January to raise the minimum wage.
Now, you commented on Vietnamese labor laws actually being some of the strongest in the world, in part because of their communist past. Why has it not been enforced in the past few years?
Well, that's an excellent question. It's difficult to tell. The government is not exactly the most open in the world. It is still a one-party state. I mean, people in Vietnam are only allowed to join one government trade union, and that government trade union only represents about 10% of the people who work in these export factories. But that's actually against the law. By Vietnamese law, every single factory in Vietnam within just a few months is required to have their workers affiliate with this government trade union. But that just hasn't been happening. And the government doesn't seem very interested in forcing companies to comply with this law. Now, whether or not that's because the government just doesn't care, whether the government is trying to keep labor conditions lousy to attract more foreign investment, or whether this is because the government simply just doesn't have enough money to enforce the laws that it has on the books, you know, this is a matter for speculation.
And what do you think accounts for the recent resurgent in labor activity? I mean, they won their demands, yet they're still striking.
Well, I think that what's accounting for the resurgence in labor activity is that people have really gotten to the breaking point. There have been strikes, over 100 a year in Vietnam, actually, ever since the country began opening up for capitalism in the mid-80s. All through the 90s, you had 100 strikes a year, all of them completely illegal. But what's new and different about these strikes is the size. You didn't usually have so many workers walking out, and usually not all at the same time. And there seems to be a lot more coordination in these strikes, and some people are saying that the government trade union, whose newspaper, Lao Dong, which means worker, has been publicizing these illegal strikes, that the government trade union might actually be helping to coordinate them, or at the very least is you know, being a facilitator, is helping to give workers information rather than helping the bosses clamp down.
Interesting. And do you notice a difference between foreign-owned factories, Vietnamese-owned factories, and state-owned factories?
Well, the worst place to work in Vietnam is no doubt in a Vietnamese-owned private factory, because these factories are allowed to pay their workers even less than the foreign-owned companies do, and they tend to give them very few benefits because they're part of the private sector, and so they don't really have to, and they're very unlikely that their workers will be represented by any kind of trade union, just like in the foreign-owned factories. The state-owned companies, the companies that are owned by the government, workers also don't get paid very well, but they tend to not have to work excessive hours. They also tend to get fringe benefits like free housing and you know, decent quality food while they're on the job. I mean, people in one of the big complaints that people working in the export sector have is that the meals that they're fed by their boss, and of course they can't leave the factory for their meals, and they work 12 or 15 hours a day sometimes, so they're eating a lot of meals at the factory, that their factory meals are just really poor quality. And, you know, the factory owners, some of them pay 5,000 or 6,000 dong, which is about 30 cents on lunch for workers. And, you know, if you go to the market and you want to buy a very, very cheap breakfast in the morning in Vietnam, it's going to cost you at least 7,000 dong, which is about 50 cents for a pretty decent breakfast. So you have people working very long, hard hours and eating very small meals in these foreign-owned factories. And so the quality of life for workers in the foreign-owned factories, even though they get paid slightly better, is usually worse. And they have tremendous turnover in their workforce, which is something that you don't usually see in the state-owned companies.
And something I found interesting in your article is that you mentioned respect as a main issue regarding one of the strikes that's happened since the minimum wage increase. Could you explain what that means?
Well, respect is a huge issue in all the strikes. It was a big issue at the Free Trend strike that sparked all of this. These are the people who are making shoes for Nike and Adidas for a Hong Kong-based company. And this Hong Kong-based company, by the way, like many companies, also maintains factories in China as well as in Vietnam. And, you know, you have, first of all, a language gap between a lot of the workers and their supervisors, from China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Korea, Singapore, Japan, acting as the intermediaries between the U.S. companies at the top of the food chain and the Vietnamese workers at the bottom. A lot of these factory owners come from military backgrounds. They used to, in the 90s, beat their workers a lot, but now that subsided, the government has indicated it will no longer tolerate that. But even though the beatings have stopped, a lot of workers still complain that they're just treated like animals.
And these companies, are they connected to international companies whose products are available in the market? Do you know which ones?
Well, these companies are all suppliers, and they all supply to different international companies. So they're not subsidiaries, and this gives kind of a plausible deniability maybe to the main retailers who sell these products of the labor conditions. So, for example, Freetrend, the company I mentioned, they're supplying to Nike and Adidas. A company that we feature in the article, De Nuvina, they are supplying plush toys to a whole number of markets, including Starbucks, including Hallmark, including the Los Angeles Dodgers, bobblehead dolls, really a lot of different companies, all coming out of this one Korean interest, De Nuvina, which, by the way, also has an office in Los Angeles. But it really varies a lot. I mean, you have almost every concern in the world there. And one of the things that's interesting is that the companies that are supplying companies in the U.S. that have faced a lot of consumer pressure, such as Nike, for example, their workers are on the whole treated better than those companies that have not felt this kind of consumer pressure. So my partner Nauka and I, we went and we reported on the workers at Freetrend who were making these shoes for Nike and Adidas. And they were working 8 hours a day, 6 days a week for the minimum wage, which was paltry. But their bosses at Freetrend were doing a very good job of following the law. And the main problem for these workers was just that the law was so lousy for them. And that's because because Nike has come under a lot of pressure by consumers in the U.S., and they've actually hired a consulting company based in Vietnam to go around and make sure that their factories that they subcontract with are following the law. Now, on the other hand, you have another company that we write about in the story, which was McDonald's, which makes many of its Happy Meal toys in Da Nang in central Vietnam through a Hong Kong-based company named Keyhinge. Now, McDonald's has not faced this kind of consumer pressure, so they are not employing this kind of outside consulting to go check on the ground. And so the company, Keyhinge, was really mistreating its workers very, very badly. They were paying below the minimum wage. They were making people work 12 to 16 hours a day. And they were, you know, you want to talk about respect, they were only giving people one bathroom break in that 12 to 16 hour day. And people complained that they only had one cup for drinking water in a factory with thousands of workers at Keyhinge. So you can see that the consumer pressure in the U.S. really does make a difference in terms of how well workers are treated on the ground in Vietnam.
Well, thank you for sharing, and we're almost out of time. But before you go, I just would like to ask you, when you were conducting research for this story, who did you speak to, and was there any difference in the stories that they would tell?
Well, one of the things we did was we went out to the areas where these strikes had happened, and we interviewed workers as they were coming out en masse, and certain workers would come up to us and talk to us, and we would hang out and try to get people's stories. You know, how many days have you been on strike? Why are you on strike? We would go out there after people were back to work. You know, what is it that got you to go back to work? People were very open with us, the workers. Now, Vietnam is a communist country, so it's very difficult to get officials to talk to you, not like the United States. So, for example, if I was doing a story about labor in the United States, I would call the trade union that was involved, and the trade union that was involved at the site will probably be also involved in the strike and would be happy to talk. But in Vietnam, as I said, these strikes are illegal and not usually sponsored with the cooperation of the government trade union. So we could not get anyone at the government trade union to talk to us for the story. We also had a lot of difficulty getting analysts and observers in Vietnam to talk to us on the record. So we had the opportunity to talk to a number of people in the government bureaucracy, people working for the United Nations and other NGOs, but not one of them, because of this lack of freedom in the communist system, was willing to go on the record with us. As for the companies, we found that when we were there together, Nock and myself, in 2003, we were able to get much more access to company officials, and they were very welcoming of us in terms of doing interviews. But nowadays, people in these intermediary companies that I was talking about are very nervous, and none of them would call us back.
Okay, well, that's a very fascinating story. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your experience with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Aaron Glantz. He wrote this week's Corp Watch feature, All Work and Low Pay. You have been listening to Corp Watch Radio, brought to you by CorpWatch.org. Special thanks goes out to Liam O'Donohue, Erica Marcus, and Prothop Chatterjee for research assistance, Stephen Valentino for anchoring, Aaron Glantz for editorial support, and David Taylor for technical assistance. You have heard music by The Art Ensemble of Chicago, Tortoise, Profuse 73, and The Ruins. I'm your host, Sakura Saunders. Thanks for listening.